You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Kevin Miller and Tommy Ahlquist. Each episode is focused on shedding new light on different perspectives to create dialogue that inspires excellence.
Welcome once again to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. Tommy Ahlquist, Kevin Miller, with probably, if not the biggest name, one of the biggest names in education, collegiate sports, and radio.
Yeah, I'm excited. We've been bugging you for a while to get on our podcast only because there's several things I'd love to talk to you about and certainly admire you, President, for all you did and at the university and get caught up. So thank you very much for taking time to be here with us today and look forward to hearing from you.
How have you been?
I'm sure people want to know. I didn't ask you.
You came
in.
You didn't.
As soon as you came in, I didn't say how's retirement because I know you and Kathy well enough that you've not slowed down at all. But what I did ask you is what have you been up to? So how has it been since you transitioned to the next phase?
Well, first of all, thanks for not asking how's retirement. Okay, I'm sick and tired of that question. And the answer to your question, though, what have you been up to? The first few months was difficult. The first few months was a little bit of an adjustment. You know, you get up in the morning and realize, I'm not going to the office anymore. And I don't have the things to do that I had just a few months ago. But because I had hosted this radio program, Reader's Corner, that interviews authors of books, and the Idaho Statesman asked me to do a weekly column, quickly, that started taking over my life. And also at the university, there's anytime there's a change in presidents, there's a lot of people who are looking for career advice. They're wondering, is this a good time to move on to something else? And I did a little bit of that over the last few months, working with some of my staff and other people who have just said, hey, do you mind giving me some time? And I've taken up a few not-for-profit board assignments. I'm on the Andrus board, and I'm on the Frank Church Institute board. And so I'm keeping really busy to the point where the only thing different about my job is that I got a lot of suits and ties to give away. I mean, you know, I don't have to wear those things anymore. But other than that, I feel really busy and really gratified by these opportunities I have.
That's great. Well, there are a few things I absolutely want to get to today because we only have about 40 minutes. And so I want to make sure I get there. And certainly just to get you prepped in your mind a little bit, I do want to talk about athletics. I know that just because you were there during this magical time, during a recession, when Boise State, I will say for me and a lot of other people that were very involved in the economy, everything else was just sucking wind. And in the middle of this, you had this thriving university. So I want to talk about that. And I want to talk about just the growth and the expansion of the university and the programs and where you took it. But I don't want to start there. I got to know you and Kathy pretty well over the last decade. And you are a true partnership. And this whole thing we do on this podcast, Inspire Excellence, can you talk to me to start with a little bit about that relationship, what it means to you, but also a little bit about how important that's been in your career, having her by your side? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been enormously important to me personally, but equally so, it has been incredibly important to the university. And frankly, it's a partnership that isn't doing so well. This kind of partnership is not doing so well anymore because Kathy came to Idaho with me and decided to retire from Medicaid consulting. She was a consultant for Deloitte Touche. She worked in her own practice. And finally, when we got this job, she said, you know what? I don't need to work anymore. I don't think I want to do that anymore. I'll just be around to help wherever I can. Well, my gosh, I mean, when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to donor relations, when it comes to building relationships in the community, Kathy was there every step of the way. And so much of the success I've had is attributed to her. But when I say that kind of partnership isn't doing so well anymore in higher education, it's because a lot of spouses who are spouses of presidents are also working full time. They may be not ready to retire the way Kathy was. And so they're off doing their thing. and the president's off doing his or her thing, but you don't have the incredible benefit that I had of somebody who was, I mean, really, Kathy was, I mean, she didn't get a dime for it because, and I offered her at one point, a lot of the presidents I know in the Mountain West Conference, for example, their wives were employees of the university and they were working in the advancement office fundraising. And I ran it by Kathy early on. I said, hey, look, I don't know what the board would think of this, but if you want me to broach it with them to get some kind of compensation for all this free time you're giving up, she said, no way, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to be a volunteer. That's the way it's got to be. And I think she was right about that, but it had to be her decision, not mine. And all day long and in the evenings, she would be working. And it wasn't just fundraising and it wasn't just, showing up at events. She was quality control. She had a way of looking at the littlest issue that was going on at the university. First of all, she was quality control on food for sure. I mean, she was right back to that chef the next morning if the dinner that she was at the night before with these donors or with these community people wasn't up to snuff. But there was a lot of other things she was following. In the some things she'd just get off the news. And I'd get home at night and she'd say, did you see what so-and-so did about this or what was said about that? And before you know it, man, she was my bird dog who could really help me sniff out these areas of less than excellence. And, you know, neither one of us have ever stood for anything but excellence in our lives. So I can't say enough for the role she played in bringing Boise State to where it is today.
You're a dynamic duo. One of my favorite Kathy stories is she, the band only gets to go to so many football games, right? A year. Funding thing. And they went to a particular game and they were stuck way up top of the stadium. And I noticed that. And she noticed that. We said, let's do something about that. That can't be the game they get to go to. And boy, we raised some money to get them to go to another game. But she's just, I wanted to start there because I'll tell you, for me, watching the two of you do what you did and lead and set a standard and drive excellence around you, it was truly a team effort. It's always been something I admired greatly in both of you.
Well, thank
you. And I'll tell you, President, the other thing, the way you treat each other, just as a third party watching, pretty inspiring to watch the way you two work together and the obvious love you have for each other, respect, friendship, just a model marriage that you don't see that often. So thanks for sharing a little bit there.
Thank you for asking.
Dr. Custer, for most of us, you've always been at Boise State, but how did you go from being so involved in Illinois politics to coming to Idaho and Idaho then, Boise State then, to now?
Mm-hmm. Kevin, that's a really interesting question that doesn't happen to many people. And I must say that there's a little bit of luck involved here. But in the second term of my lieutenant governorship in Illinois, I ran for the U.S. Senate. In a primary. I didn't intend to run in a primary. I thought I was just going to run in a general and beat the Democrat.
Right.
But as it turns out, a Republican who today would be called Tea Party, a very conservative Republican, ran, came out of nowhere, really, and caught me off guard and caught the party off guard, caught everybody off guard, because I clearly had all the endorsements I needed to get elected. And he won. Not by very much, but it doesn't make any difference. If you win, you win. And if you lose, you lose. So I had to rethink where the Republican Party was going at that point. And Kathy was really critical on this one. We weren't that impressed with Gingrich and the direction he was taking the party, the way they were excluding, they were making the tent smaller instead of larger. A lot of our good friends who were in the party were starting to question whether they should be in it. And we thought, what about higher education? I taught for 28 years in the classroom. Let's try to pull it off. And at the time, the governor appointed me the chair of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. And basically, I used that to move into a position at Eastern Kentucky University as president. I was there for 3 years. I didn't like Kentucky that much. I didn't think it was the most open-minded state in the nation. And there were just some things about it that rubbed me the wrong way. And after 3 years, I decided, actually, this is my personal decision. And Kathy was working for the governor of Kentucky, and he was a pretty good guy, actually. And So I said, you know, I can't do this anymore. So I quit. I just informed the board that I was going to leave. And for a year or so, I wondered if I wanted to go back to being a president or not. And then one day I saw this ad. Lots of people think for some reason that I was recruited or that, you know, they came after me. It's always more impressive to say they came after me. You know, nobody came after me. I read in the Chronicle of Higher Education, they were looking for a president of Boise State. And I thought, yeah, I've never been to Idaho, never been to Boise. It sounds like an interesting place. Why don't I check it out? And 80 candidates later, I managed to get the job. And that was, of course, in 2003.
80 candidates. Wow.
Yeah, there were about 80 candidates at the time. And I came out here for four visits. The first visit, I stayed at one of those hotels along Park Center. It was called the Red Lion then. And I'll never forget, I saw a guy on a bike. And I said, what are you doing with that bike? He said, well, there's a green belt right behind the hotel. And I said, well, where do you get this bike? So I got the bike. I rented a bike prior to my first interview for this job. And I took it out to Barber Park. And on the way out, I got my cell phone out and I called Kathy. I said, you wouldn't believe where I am, but I'm going alongside this river. I'm looking at the foothills. I'm headed for this park that they've got right up here. I said, I think I need to get off of this bike, get back in the room and practice for my first interview because I can't get too excited about this job. There's way too many candidates in it. And that's when I knew I fell in love with Boise right off the bat. And then as I got to know the university, it was just a slam dunk. And there was such great opportunity here to build a place and to increase the stature of the university. What a blessing.
So let's start there in 03, just because I think watching what happened from the outside, first of all, I'd love to hear your take on building a team. Mm-hmm. Because I think who you kind of surrounded yourself with and then navigating, you got to navigate the academic side of building programs and how do you fund it and how do you grow? Mm-hmm. It's a big business that you got to run and make it profitable and make sense of it. And then in the middle of all this, you have athletics that, I'd love to know what your first impression was of athletics in 03. Cause certainly there had been success before.
Sure.
But president, you go from 03 and you take your journey you took with this school and how important football was in that journey and in the Big East and back in and out and the conference juggling and
right.
And ADs coming and going. What an incredible ride. That's a big question.
Yeah.
Tell us what that was like.
Well, I'll tell you the funniest part of it is that I'm sitting there in Minneapolis, Minnesota at a job just learning I'm going to be the next president of Boise State. And I look down at my email and I got an email from Dan Hawkins. Oh yeah, the football coach. I remember when I was over in the Noble Center and met all these folks that, you know, he was the football coach, all right. And he says in the email, look, I just want to check in with you to see what kind of a sports fan you are and if you're going to support this football program. And he said in the process, which is nationally ranked at the time, okay. I got off the email and I called Kathy and I said, do you know anything about these national rankings? I said, that couldn't be the national ranking. Is there another ranking system that maybe Boise State made that, you know, the lesser beings of the sports world? And she checked it out and she said, no, she said, that is the national ranking. They're nationally ranked, you know, and that'll give you some indication of how little I knew about this sports program. And then I got here and I just loved Hawkins. I mean, Dan was great to work with. And then, of course, he takes off. And I spent a lot of time trying to talk Dan Hawkins. He would have to admit this. He, in my office, I tried to talk him out of going to Colorado. I said, you're 42 years old. You got your whole life ahead of you. Don't rush it. Take it easy. Do a few more great things here. Well, he chose to go. And then I remember, you know, all of a sudden, Gene Blamire, who was the AD at the time, comes in and says, Chris Peterson's going to be the new coach. And I didn't know Chris that well, you know. And I said, is that a good idea as opposed to doing a national search? you know, because I was big on national searches. When I put my own team together, I knew there was always some inside candidate that was interested. But I always told everybody, look, you've got to outperform everybody else in this country if you're going to get this job. And that's the way I felt about it. And Gene said, don't worry. You know, as far as Chris Peterson is concerned, we're going to be okay. Well, obviously, we were very okay. And the next chapter of this story, but I'll hand it back to you, is what Chris did for us. And it was Dan's work as well, because 2007 in the first Fiesta Bowl is really what changed the destiny of Boise State University.
It was.
Yeah.
I was there. And I've told the story a couple of times on this podcast, but I'm there with my son. We're sitting down in the family section with all the players' families, and that game, I'll never be at a moment like that in as a fan. It was the most incredible experience ever, and watching what you did with it, because it wasn't just the game afterwards. What you were able to do, and how you took the program after that. Tell us what was going through your mind once that game's over and you win the game. How did you parlay that into what it became afterwards?
Yeah, well, the first thing that happened is getting back to my office and finding somewhere around 300 to 350 emails from people all over the country. Many of them from the Big 12, delighted to see that we knocked off Oklahoma. Okay, so I have to admit there was a lot of partisanship going on there in those emails. But there were other emails from people, and the story was the same. You know, well, I almost turned the TV off, and then all of a sudden it went into overtime. And you know the stories you've heard from so many people. And it occurred to me, you know, I think this has more to it. It's not just about football, even though we want to keep the program going and go back to that second Fiesta Bowl and even the third. But how can we grow the university? How can we increase the stature of the entire university and build it on top of what was initially a victory by the football team? And the answer to that I came up with, I called in the enrollment management people, the people that do the recruiting of students. And I said, look, why don't you go to the high schools of the kids who just won that football game, find their academic all-stars and start talking about Boise State's engineering program, its MFA program in creative writing, its biology degree that'll take you off to a medical school. And so we started doing that. And that was, we were getting a few California students. I mean, in those days, the overall out-of-state enrollment was 7%. Right now, I think it's approaching 30, and of the first-year classes, it keeps going up because I think 40% of our students now in the first-year class are from out of state, and most of those are from California. So the word started spreading. Once we took in some of these California kids, and I have to admit that at the same time, the California state system and the UCal system were struggling. They weren't doing well as far as funding. We had a lot of parents come to us and say, you know, these places are dirty. And they're not clean like you guys are. And you don't have the beauty that you have. And other parents would say, I took my kid to a California school the other day, and they told me that he's going to get out in 5.5 years with an undergraduate degree. And you're telling us that you'll guarantee they can get out in 4. Well, before you know it, they started coming. And our great success today, which now is really just year after year compounded, is the what I call marketing by word of mouth, where moms and dads are sitting in high school football stands watching a game, and they're talking to their friends who have a kid who's a junior or a sophomore. And they say, well, I've got a kid at Boise State, and I got to tell you should take a look at it, because it's a great place to get an education, and it's way better than anything we can find in California. And by the way, this also goes for the state of Washington, the Seattle area. They're coming down to us in droves from Seattle. But it all started with football. And the second and third Fiesta Bowls certainly helped as well. The character of the program, the character of the coaches, the character of the student athletes. I mean, it was a national story. And there's just no doubt that when you tell the story of Boise State, you must say that our academic quality, reaching Carnegie status, research to university, it's built on the shoulders of the football program. And I don't want to single out football alone. Let's face it. In the meantime, if you took a look at our swimming and diving team right now, we get almost all of our kids from swimming and diving from other states, and probably the same with soccer and softball. So whether it's the women athletes or the men athletes, they're coming from all over the nation now. And every time one of them goes back and talks about where they came from, it's just another free advertisement for Boise State University.
For our listeners, I've heard this before, but the importance of this, because if you look at funding from the state and how much of your funding has to come not from tax dollars in the state, at the same time, let's be honest too, you got the University of Idaho, which politically and just with alumni, you kind of got the deck stacked against you for dollars that do come through the state board. That's just the way it was. But I can only imagine back in 03 what it was like.
Yeah.
And then you got Idaho State. I mean, you're in the middle of, you know, here right. You are, little Boise State, and you're trying to take advantage of a football win. But more importantly, this gets back to funding, because people listening might say, well, what's the big deal about bringing in out-of-state students? But talk about how that impacts your finances.
Yeah. Well, two things. First of all, before we get to the out-of-state students, I'm glad you mentioned the University of Idaho and Idaho State. When I got here in 2003, I was really unimpressed with the fact that Boise State did not appear to be the city's university. I mean, it was like if the city had a university, it was the University of Idaho. There's only one problem with that. It was 7 hours away. And I couldn't figure out how this university, you can walk to it from downtown. And people weren't acting like we own Boise State. It's our university. The other two or three are great, but this one's ours. So we put a very specific campaign together, working with the mayor. I mean, Mayor Beter showed up at one of our halftime events dressed in black. And I had to call him aside and say, you know, Mayor, that's not a good idea. I tell you what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to send you an outfit that's blue and orange. And on Monday morning, he got an outfit from the bookstore, compliments of the president's office, that was blue and orange. Okay. This is what you wear to a football game at halftime. All right. Anyway, the fact of the matter is, we over the years really had to focus in on the fact that this is Boise's university. Why doesn't Boise act like it? Okay. And I think today there's no question about that. The out-of-state issue is really important because you're right. The state appropriation wasn't growing any larger. And one of the ways which we knew we could fund the university was to get that out-of-state tuition. So the decision to go beyond the state of Idaho and bring in students from other states like Washington and California, Arizona, and wherever, that was based in part. I wouldn't say entirely, because I think it's also important for a Boise State University, especially its students, to work alongside, study alongside, get to know kids from other places. I don't care whether they're coming from China or India or whether they're coming from Southern California. You should be in a classroom with kids from other places where you're sharing their cultural experiences. You're learning how different or how alike they are from you. And let's face it, for the rest of your life, you're going to be someplace where you have to do that. So we better figure that out at Boise State. But the fact is, in addition to all those good reasons, there was also the financial reason that we can really get this university moving if we can get that out-of-state enrollment. The out-of-state enrollment tuition fee is not as great as it may seem, because there's actually a tuition break for out-of-state students from most of the Western states. So they pay about half of the out-of-state fees, but it's still a nice way to collect extra revenue that we can then throw back into the faculty, the quality of the faculty, the student services, and everything else.
I've always thought it was interesting. Branding and culture make a huge difference, right? I mean, they just do. And if you look at enrollment at those other universities during the same time, and then I just a real quick experience, personal experience, Shannon and I were down at Coronado Island in San Diego, and a very nice gal was checking us into our place and said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Boise." And she just lit up. And I said, "You know, Boise." She said, "I just graduated." She was very delightful and just had graduated from Boise State. I said, "Tell me, you know, you're from California, how did you get to Boise State? And she just said, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Everyone here knows that if you want to go get a great education in a great city with a safe, clean culture,
absolutely,
that's where you go. So that's where almost all my friends in all the way through college, I mean, high school, they're talking about Boise State. And I thought, that just doesn't happen. You think about all of the hard work that went into when you got here to branding this thing, that it is an excellent education, great place to come and live. And I thought, you know, next time I saw you, I was going to tell you that story. Yeah. But
let me tell you something about that branding thing, because it ties the academics and athletics together in a really cool way. Nike, at some point, Chris Peterson had a great relationship with Nike. I'm sure a number of the coaches did. But this was during the time when Chris was really tight with Nike. They came to us and said, would you like us to do a branding exercise for you and see where you are? And we had some goofy logo that had these lines in it. It was supposed to be the river, and it was everybody was wearing these little lapel pins that made no sense to anybody. You know, it just didn't register. And we paid about $80,000 for that's before I got here. We paid about $80,000 for that, I guess. And the faculty and the staff were always carping over the fact that it didn't make any damn sense anyway. So yeah, we called this Nike in, and they did it for free. Well, before they even came in, we wondered, now let's see, let's go up and down the West Coast, Oregon. Oh, is there anybody who's ever seen the O that doesn't know what that stands for, whether it's on the academic side or the athletic side? And of course, the answer is no, not many people would have any trouble figuring that out. So anyway, we suggested to Nike to take a look at that, and we came up with the B. All right. Now, until then, the athletic department ran like it was its own family business. You know, it was over there thinking that it was kind of a part of the university, but they got to do what they wanted when they wanted to do it, and they weren't paying too much attention to us. And I just felt it was really important that we bring it all together the way Oregon brought it all together. So Nike comes through and says, yeah, you can do that, and here's how you do it. So they gave us the B. Well, the next thing is, now how do we convince the athletic department to put something on a helmet or on your jacket that isn't a Bronco, okay? Because there was only one logo, and that's what it was. At the time, I think this was by the time Harsin got here. I don't think it was Chris, but we trotted out the B, and one day Kathy calls me. And she said, you got to take a look, go online and go to the athletic department. Take a look at what helmet they're going to be wearing this Saturday. And sure enough, Harsin took it on himself to put the B on the helmet. And all of a sudden, it was like a moment of truth, you know, where, oh, my God, you know, the athletic department and the rest of the university have kind of come together, recognizing that, hey, man, we're all in this together. Let's brand together. And Coach Harsin has been great about that ever since.
That's fantastic.
Dr. Custer, friend or foe, people would never, ever say that you're not a tough person. Tough but fair. What is the source of your drive? What is the source of your toughness?
You know, Kevin, that's an interesting question. I mean, I don't look at myself as tough.
Maybe passionate.
Passionate for sure. My mother is the answer to that. You know, I grew up with a mom who was always there for her kids. Now everybody can say their mom's there for their kids. No, I mean a mom that fought for her kids. I think she would have duked it out with somebody if it was required. Okay. So the slightest thing that happened to us, whether it was, I grew up in Catholic schools, and I don't care whether it was a priest or a nun or a lay teacher that somehow, you know, wasn't paying respect or didn't treat us properly or misused their authority, she was there. She was there raising Cain about it. I mean, she was just that kind of person. And she was very passionate in every way. My dad was the silent type. You know, he was the quietest man I think I've ever known. And so he was not the guy that was ready to jump up and charge San Juan Hill, but my mother was, and I'm sure the passion in me about whatever I'm doing, if I love doing it, I get that from her. I to this day, you know, I have their photos on my desk, and I think of them often. I mean, each in their own way. My dad was a supervisor and ran, oversaw a lot of people in an office. And he was an eighth grade, he had an eighth grade education. You know, I mean, it was the days when you just, you learn by pulling up your bootstraps. And he was tough. So I guess when it comes to making a tough decision, I'm sure that had something to do with the way he approached his own life and career, and obviously passed a little of it on to me. But he was not a man of very few. He was a man of very few words. Where my mother was, where I got the ability to persuade and convince and be very passionate about what I'm doing.
I'm gonna ask you one more follow up to that. If you, President, if you look at the results, this results of your time at BSU, and then you add that to the anecdotal just experiences of just being around you and watching you lead, I would call you tough. I definitely would call you tough. But I also, the next word would come would be vision. Tell us a little bit about, I mean, teach us. You are a man that can look at something like a university and have a vision for what it can be, and then you execute on that. That is not an easy thing to do in life, mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about higher education. I look at you and what you did there, how you connected to the business community. I mean, you connected. You molded programs around what was needed here in the state. Your results speak for themselves there. But how would you tell a listener about vision and how you take passion and that toughness, but you drive for excellence and results? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to, you know, how do you engage a business community and how do you work with them and help them see what a university can be and what kind of a partnership, I do have to remember that I had 18 years serving as a retail politician. And retail politics, you know something about that, Tommy.
I'm forgetting more and more every day. I'm sorry. Wednesday was the 1 year anniversary, and I took my dog and went to the hills and thanked the dear Lord that I didn't win.
But. Right, right. I hear you on that one. That's what I did in 1996. But bottom line, some of it's accidental. But some of it is the fact that over the years, in my 18 years, 10 years in the legislature, 8 years as lieutenant governor, I was spending all of my time using the skills of persuasion, trying to bring people to the table, keep people at the table, convince people of whatever it was we were trying to do in our administration. And that was an enormous benefit to being a university president. On the other side, and this is the side Kathy always likes to point out, is that 28 years in the classroom and working in higher education also gave me an opportunity to understand what might be the goofiest form of administration in the world. And that's the university administration, because, I mean, it's a strange place. You know, as they jokingly say, the inmates are in charge. There's more independence on faculty. If they don't like you for a while, they'll throw a vote of no confidence. Like, you know how effective that would be if they did that here to you, right?
Yeah.
Because you're in charge. But a university president sometimes wakes up in the morning wondering if indeed he is in charge or she is in charge. And so getting to know how to handle both sides of the job that's outside, and then the job that's inside in terms of dealing with the faculty, you really have to have a few skills that you pick up along the way. And I think I did understand the faculty's concerns and know how to deal with them effectively, that really helped it along the way. The accidental part of it is interesting, because when I got here in 2003, I read the strategic plan of Boise State of the year 2000. And it said something about we're an urban university and we want to be involved in research. And I thought, urban, I don't really see, when I think of urban, I think of Chicago or San Francisco or LA, but urban, really? Boise? That doesn't make any sense. And in one of my first speeches, I landed on, Boise State's future is that of a Metropolitan Research University of Distinction. And I swear to God, it just came right out of my brain at that moment. It's not like I went and thought about, let's see, vision politics 101. How do I put together? It just came out. And when after I said it, I thought, gee, that had a pretty nice ring to it. Maybe I'll try this a second time. You know, so I used it a second time and a third time. And before you know it, I begin in the community and I'm having community people tell me what we were going to be. Yeah, well, this Metropolitan Research University of Distinction you've got in mind, you know, and it took off. And once it took off, then all we had to do is fill in the details. Okay, so what does a research university of distinction mean? Well, it means getting a Carnegie designation. And I had to move some people around because there were people at Boise State when I got here who absolutely were convinced we should do nothing but educate undergraduates, have maybe a sprinkling of master's degrees, but certainly no PhDs, and that we should have very little research because we were originally a commuter college and we were a junior college and we shouldn't be anything more. And I found some folks who understood how Boise was going to grow and how we were going to develop and how this region needed a school that was not just teaching undergraduates, but offering master's degrees and MBAs and eventually PhDs, and with the major hospital and healthcare emphasis in this state, we certainly needed a science program and significant graduate work in sciences and research. And then you throw in engineering because of Micron and HP and all the spinoffs. It just all started falling in place. And it was by the time I was here for maybe 5 or 10 years, it was easy to have people understand that, oh yeah, we can't just serve undergraduates, although that is a core part of our mission.
Dr. Custer, speaking of business, and I'll try and relate both aspects to this, you know, two-part question, which was tougher, dealing with politics at the state and national level or dealing with the ever-changing role of collegiate athletics?
You know, I really enjoyed the ever-changing role of intercollegiate athletics. I have to say that going back to my first job at Eastern Kentucky University, what I knew about intercollegiate athletics, you could put in a thimble. I mean, it was really unbelievable. I just didn't know what was going on. I had a half-time AD at Eastern Kentucky University, and the first thing I did is hire a full-time AD. And then the full-time AD ended up giving me an education. And by the time I got to Boise State, I think I knew what was going on. But then at the national level, the things started changing rather dramatically. And that's when I got on this anti-BCS kick I was on for a few years, where we were trying to fight the big guys. I mean, in a sense, that fight's still going on. But there's certainly more recognition, more opportunity today. Our affiliations over the years with the Western Athletic Conference, one year with the Big East, with the Mountain West Conference, were probably some of the most refreshing moments I've had in my presidency, meeting presidents of universities who were just like me. We didn't come from coaching backgrounds. We didn't necessarily grow up eating, drinking, and thinking about sports all the time. But we understood the value of the sports program to the entire university. And so some of my fondest memories of president is really, you know, taking off on these issues that we thought were so critical to Boise State, the BCS run especially. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I was sitting on the NCAA board at the time, and I saw how belittled we were by these big guys and how little respect they showed us. And the only way to do something about that is beat them on the field. And we were doing a really good job of that in those days. And then keep hammering away at equity. And again, there's more of that today than ever before. The other job of dealing with the legislature, let me tell you, after 18 years of politics in the legislature and lieutenant governor back in Illinois, I wasn't interested. I wasn't excited about going into the legislature and having to fight for the appropriation or defend something that happened on our campus. I mean, early on in my presidency, I think it happened before I got here. A speaker came to the campus who was gay and gave a speech. And he probably was talking about sexual preference or something. I don't know. I actually got called in. The I still know this guy's name, and thank goodness somebody defeated him. And I might have even sent a check to the person who ran against him. But in any event, the guy called me in and had a special hearing, a special committee, where he just accosted me personally for the fact that somebody showed up on the Boise State campus to give a speech for gay rights or something, whatever it was. And I mean, give me a break. I don't care whether what your position is. I don't think that was a very good way of handling it. And if that's one example, I could probably give you 20 examples where some legislator is raising a concern about free speech or some other aspect of the university's business that isn't their business, you know, and especially when you're only getting 17% of your funding from the legislature. That was the biggest joke of it all, is that these folks would have us in their education committees, and they'd have us in the JFAC committee, the Joint Finance and Appropriation Committee. And the way they quizzed you and grilled you and held you accountable, you would think if anybody walked into the room, ooh, they must be getting 80 to 90% of their funding from this legislature. 17%. And to this day, it's the same way. I mean, nothing's changed. Even in my retirement, I write a column that criticizes our U.S. senators, and Boise State hears about it from legislators who want to know what right I have to speak my piece when I'm no longer president of the university. But it's a good example of how narrow-minded those characters are. And it's the most one of the most regressive states I know of as far as politics. So let me tell you, they had to drag me up there a lot of times to testify and to do my thing over the 15 years I was there. And I always had a smile on my face. And I don't think very few people were ever able to detect that I disliked that part of the job as much as I did. But, you got to put your best foot forward when, in fact, you've got the entire university to worry about.
We're almost out of time. One more question, and Kevin will ask the last one, but any advice you'd have for the new president? You probably have already talked to her, but just for the public that's listening to this, where do you see the university going? What would you tell her?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm really excited about her. I love the fact that she's at an R1 university, University of California, Santa Cruz. I love the fact even more that she worked down at Arizona State for Michael Crow, who is arguably the number one transformative president in America. Arizona State, he's renamed it and redefined it. It's really a big deal. So I'm very excited about the fact that we have somebody who worked for him, and she came here and mentioned that. And I guess Michael even suggested to her, hey, if you get a crack at this job, you should take it. Some of our people have worked with Michael over the years, and he knows who we are, and he knows what we've done. So I'm really excited about that. I think what I would tell her, and by the way, we've emailed back and forth. I haven't had a chance to meet her yet. But I would simply say, look, this is a job that is as much about presentation skills and external duties and affairs than it is about keeping track of academic programs. Presidents hire provost to take care of the quality of the academic programming. And if you hire a good one, that job will be done. But what's critical about the university presidency today is that you need more and more skills that are unrelated to academicians and the backgrounds they've had. So the good news for us is that I think we managed to, get both in this case, because she's got a very stellar academic record, but everybody told me who saw her presentation skills were off the charts. She's really good. And I think she's just going to have to get to know the legislature, the donor community, the governor, all the people that count. And I have no doubt she's going to do great things here. And her goal, by the way, I think she said this, is that, hey, look, right now we're in R2. There's three categories of being a research university in the Carnegie. And we're in the middle category. We went in at number one. We jumped to number two. And there's a third category. And that's where she wants to take us. Boy, that's good news for the state of Idaho. It's good news for Boise and the region, and great news for Boise State.
Dr. Custer, what inspires you?
Well, you know, I read a lot, and I'm always looking for inspiration from what I read. I'm not one of these guys that goes to the business section of the bookstore to find some consultant who wrote the latest inspirational book on how to motivate people. I don't do that. I read very different kinds of books. I read fiction. I read novels. I read history. And I'm always looking for inspiration in the real lives of people and in the fictional lives of people who have made a difference in this world. And I mean, you know, right on down to last week when I interviewed a guy who had written about the shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, where 9 churchgoers were killed by a shooter that was a white nationalist. And the book is about how the leader of the white nationalist movement, actually the son of the leader of the white nationalist movement, changed, transformed, decided something's wrong with this, with the underpinnings of this movement. It's not right. And the book that I was interviewing the author about is called Rising Out of Hatred. And it's the story of how 2 college students who were friends of this white nationalist invited him to dinner on a weekly basis and started plumbing to the depths about, why do you feel this way? And what sense does it make? They've converted him. He is now on the hustings, speaking out about the error of his ways. And he would have been, had he not converted, he would have been the leader of the white nationalist community on a website called Stormwatch, which his father founded and still operates today. That's a heck of an inspirational speech. And it gives me inspiration because it helps me understand the importance of free speech on campuses. Some of the students, this was the new college at Sarasota, Florida. Some of the students wanted to kick this kid off campus. And where's the inspiration? Other students said, no, he has his free speech rights. You got to let him say what he wants, what he believes in. But it doesn't mean we can't work him over. And they worked him over. And they converted him. Anyway, one small example of a recent interview I had that I think was really inspirational as far as I'm concerned.
Well, President, thank you for coming on with us. And thank you for you and Kath for your friendship through my little political endeavor. And just look up to you both.
Well, thank you
very
for
much.
Your friendship. And, appreciate it, Tommy.
Can't wait to watch you continue to do great things and continue to inspire people. Great. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you again, Kevin.
Thank you, Dr. Custer. We appreciate you, sir. And everyone, thank you for listening and strive for excellence.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. We invite you to find something that inspires you this week. Join us again for our next episode.